your activities and see if we can't get into some things, like, for instance...
Okay, away we go.
Right. This is Jeffrey Sturchill, and we're interviewing Dr. Arnold Beckman from the Center for History of Chemistry today, April 23rd, 1985, in Smith Hall at the University of Pennsylvania. With me are Arnold Thackeray, Director of the Center, and Eric Elliott. Dr. Beckman, from the oral history memoir on deposit at Caltech,
I went to Lewis's school at Berkeley. You had contacts with Rhoda Bush, who'd come from that school. What was Caltech like, and what sort of things did you do that first year?
Well, I taught freshman chemistry, for which I was paid, and then took the usual courses. The chemists at that time had to take quite a bit of physics. Say, this is when quantum theory was in its very controversial stage, and I know we had our text was Arnold Sommerfeld's Atombau, and which we had to read in German, which is bad enough for itself, particularly Arnold Sommerfeld's style was not particularly clear, and try to get this controversial quantum theory, so that was a tough job. People like Pauling, that could go through it, but I know I had a struggle with the biggest. But it was exciting. And we had visitors, of course. Einstein was there, and Sommerfeld himself was there. Heisenberg came in, and Bohr, the real chief actors in the drama, visited Caltech. This undoubtedly was due to the preeminence of Millikan and Hale, plus Noyes' emphasis on, if we're going to be in a discipline, we want to be second to none. So they went out of their way to bring these leaders out there, and so the students could be exposed to them.
And you referred in an earlier interview to the atmosphere at Caltech being very intimate between graduate students and faculty because of the size of the institute.
That's still the situation.
And how was, could you talk a little about the contrast between Illinois and Caltech in that first year, in addition to these luminaries coming to visit? What other differences did you find?
Well, you have to keep in mind when I'm 21 years old, I looked up to any professor with a good deal of awe. If I got a little older, why some of that awe diminished. But nevertheless, when I went to Caltech, I remember if Millikan called me in to see him, I would go in with a great deal of trepidation. Well, now, gee, what I got to do? Later on, when I got to know Millikan, why... those feelings disappeared, and I found that the faculty and the student body worked together and in very close relationship. There's no difficulty in a student being able to go in and see a professor. It's always welcome. That was one of the redeeming, but one of the top features of being with a small school like Caltech.
Noyes apparently was known as the king.
That's right. Well, he was called the king, and Millikan was called the chief. How they got those names, I don't know. They just developed.
And what did that reflect about Noyes' style in running the chemistry?
Well, I think it reflected both of them were at the top, on the top of the heap. And, you know, the king was not, what shall I say, he didn't throw his weight around or tell people to do this way, but his influence was quietly felt. For example, he set the policies of the thought policies of the Institute, and he was very, very shy person, just the opposite of Millikan. Mm-hmm. You'd almost never see Noyes at a public gathering, for example, mm-hmm. whereas Millikan would be there, usually fundraising, mm-hmm. so talking about science.
Mm-hmm. The explicit style of Caltech seems in so many ways different from Illinois, the large institution, the small institution, and so on. What about the industrial connections and linkages? Did you sense a difference in style there?
Caltech did not have a chemical engineering department at that time. They didn't have what they call the applied chemistry, and Dr. William Lacey was the head of that. And in fact, he was it. And later on, Bruce Sage came in, and the two of them and that. Well, this is a recognition that there was, in fact, an applied science side of chemistry, and Dr. Noyes was that. But the curriculum was rather limited. It's more devoted to theoretical aspects of chemical engineering than it was to the experimental side on there. And it became rather narrowly focused, particularly when Bruce Sage came there to study the thermodynamic properties of hydrocarbons under Bryce Cadacia. So that took up a big part of their time.
And did students like yourself move naturally between that and the regular chemistry, or was the were these really separately organized?
No, there was no sharp borderline in there at all.
And did you get to know Roscoe Dickinson your first year there? Was that
yes.
Had you made a decision who you wanted to work with that year, or was that after you came back from Bell Labs?
No, that's after I got to Caltech. Mm. Talked it over with Tolman, decided that Dickinson might be a good person to work with, and he was a good experimentalist, and I enjoyed working with him. He, although was working with more in X-ray diffraction, and I was not so much interested in that. I was interested in applying the quantum theory to setting of chemical reactions.
So that dates from your
very
first year
yes,
at Caltech.
Right.
But that, as you told us earlier, that at the end of that year you had a chance to go back east,
yes.
And after going through the Panama Canal on a steamer back to New York to see the future Mrs. Beckman, you ended up with a job at what became Bell Telephone Laboratories. And
yes.
I wonder if we could just move to that for a while. First, I'm interested, why was it that you went first to Standard Oil? Was that just, you knew of, that Standard Oil was
I
there?
Knew of them, and...
And they needed analytical tests. But later that afternoon, you found your friend from Caltech, Todd Neese, I believe is his name.
Todd Neese, yes.
And ended up working with Western Electric Engineering in Walter Shewhart's area of statistical analysis for quality control. Shewhart was, his work in inspection engineering was an aspect of Bell Labs that wasn't really connected with chemistry at all. And I just wondered if you had any contact with the chemists at Bell Labs while you were there.
Not really. No, the only contact would be possibly an occasional talk at a seminar or something like that. But no, I was never in the laboratory. In fact, that was one reason why I wanted to get back and get my degree. I missed the association of being with chemists and the smell of the laboratory and be able to do things with my hands. And
if you did you at that moment have a conscious determination of where you were heading, what career you wanted or
no,
thought you were going to?
In all honesty, I can't. I wasn't thinking that seriously about the future. I was I needed some money to go back to school. I had a girlfriend there, and those are thoughts that are uppermost in my mind.
That should be extracted and put in text, because I think very often students worry that they haven't got a clear enough view.
No, I never worried about that, and I think one reason may be the way I spent that summer of 1919. Remember I told you how I bummed out west with a friend? And I learned I could take care of myself, no matter what it was. So what my future life is going to be really was never a great concern to me.
Yeah, that's very interesting. It's a good argument for having breaks between high school
yeah.
and college and
right.
college and graduate school.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, while working with Shewhart on statistical analysis and quality control, you mentioned that, this was in the West Street laboratories of Bell Labs at the
yeah.
time, but there was a vacuum tube shop run by Mervyn Kelly.
Yeah, down Hudson Street.
And so this must have been your first encounter with vacuum tubes.
Yes. Yes, and I recall that when we applied the inspection techniques, we found out that Western Electric was throwing away its money doing inspection on tubes, because all of them fell within the limits on there. There were no defects. So that was one of the first applications of this thing. Mm-hmm.
And is that what began to pique your interest in these tubes, or?
No, I would say more it was the seminars that they would hold from time to time on applications of electronics or telephonic communications and things of that sort.
Now there were also in the Bell Labs Record and in the Bell System Technical Journal at the time a lot of articles on
yes.
circuit theory and applications in the telephone industry. There was Carl Darrow's series on the quantum theory. Did you follow those while they came out?
Well, yes, at the time. That was what, the Bell Telephone Journal, they call it, was it like that? See, what was the editor's name?
Mills edited?
Huh?
Mills was the editor for a while.
It didn't sound right. Well, anyway, I was often envious of him. Here's a fellow that didn't have to do anything except read the literature and keep informed of what was going on. And said, what a heck of an interesting job that was. And he did a good job, too.
Well,
and
that was Darrow who wrote
Darrow, I guess, Darrow, that was right, yes.
And so those were those read by most people at the labs? Or
oh, yes. I think so.
What's the, again, going to style? The Bell Labs obviously was not an academic institution. Did you really feel a very great difference in the workaday world there, or was it really not all that different from the Caltech ambiance in certain ways?
I don't think it was all that different, because my job was applying probability theory, so I was doing really theoretical applications of various probability theories to different types of inspection. I had a little field work, of course. I'd go out and inspect solder joints or telephone relays and then apply them back. But it still had pretty much an academic approach. We're trying to find out to what extent do the theories stand up in practice.
Did you find, in reading Shewhart's writings during these years on quality control charts, on applying statistics to manufacturing quality control, and it comes through very strongly that here was a man who had a very fine sense of the importance of only pushing your data as far as they'll go. I mean, he comes back again and again to the importance of statistics in analyzing experimental data. Did you find that that was any use to you in your career when you got back to Caltech and then later on in Beckman Institute?
Well, I hadn't thought of it, but now that you bring it up, I think so, because I've often said that one important thing, whether it's in science or business, is to have intellectual integrity. Don't allow yourself to indulge in wishful thinking. And that was what Shewhart is. He would not go along till he found some results that agreed with his preconceived ideas. He'd go along, he was just as completely objective, I think, as a person could be. And I think that probably I got a little bit of that spirit of that type of investigation from him.
Mm-hmm. And that also, it must have been difficult work. I here's an example from his article on quality control charts of the sorts of forms that you must have been using.
Skew factor, kurtosis, all these things, yes. Yes, we tried many different types of probability theory, a priori and a posteriori, sort of a bit of Bayes' theorem, something like that, you know, and small numbers theorem. It was.
But these all had to be calculated by hand, didn't they?
That's right. That was in the days before computers.
Well, that must have also increased your appreciation for doing things right and getting it.
And our inspection, of course, also had to be by hand. I mean, we'd flip pennies and toss coin, in other words, and do other sorts of things to check things. Then when I'd go out in the field, I recall coming here to Philadelphia, for example. Mm-hmm. This is one of the highlights of my career down here at the Penny Packer Exchange. I thought that was the strangest name, but they're just putting in the Penny Packer Exchange, and I go in and inspect solder joints and relay contacts and by different methods percentages and to see what the reliability factor was for different percentage of sampling and things of that sort. Then I had another interesting experience that had nothing to do with inspection, but shows how side issues come into your life. I was down one summer evening, had nothing to do, and walked down a street. I'm not sure the name of the street now, but it was one where they had the medicine shows out there. Perhaps you know the name of the street now. It's like Main Street in Los Angeles, but I don't know what it's called here. Anyway, here was a fellow going to sell snake oil to the public. He had a banjo player out there bringing a crowd, and I like banjo players. I thought, listen to this fellow. He was good. Pretty soon the barker came out with his oil. He's going to sell this medicine. Bottle that would cure everything from falling hair to stomach pains or whatnot, you know. And he'd get a very impassioned pitch. For only $1 he could get this thing put out. Not a single buyer. Thought, gee, that fellow must be kind of discouraged after all. Good banjo show there, and then not first bio. Instead of that, he broke out into a great big smile. Says, "Folks, says you don't know how happy you made me. You don't know me. I could tell you anything, but I'm glad to see that you're smart enough not to be taken in by that. But folks, you don't have to take my word for it. You can read it on the label yourself." And he passed the stuff out, and the money began to come in like that. But from that, I learned the value of the printed word over the spoken word.
It's a valuable lesson to have.
Right.
I take it you didn't buy a bottle,
though. I didn't buy it, no.
Well, if we can just get back for a minute to quantum mechanics, while you were at Western Electric Engineering, and then in January 1925 it became Bell Labs. Would you say that the knowledge and interest in applying the new quantum theory was greater at Caltech than at Bell Labs, or how well informed were people in the two places? Because these were clearly two of the centers of academic and industrial work in the mid-20s in the U.S. where the knowledge of the new quantum theory was most advanced.
Well, it was a number one priority at Caltech, mm-hmm. both in chemistry and in physics. At Bell Labs, I just don't know to what extent that dominated their thinking. They had so many practical problems, yeah. having to deal directly with communications and manage inspections and things like that, so I couldn't.
Do you recall any of the colloquia that might have dealt
with it? No, I don't recall any colloquia or seminars devoted to quantum theory.
So it was mainly just Darrow reading the literature and writing. That's interesting to you.
Undoubtedly, it was Carl Darrow, wasn't it?
Yes.
Carl Darrow had articles on it because he covered the mm-hmm. waterfront on this thing.
What sort of personal relations were there among the people at Bell Labs? Was it a very large organization, so you felt lost in it? You only dealt with Schuhart mainly?
Well, it was a large organization, but they had small groups. In our group dealing with inspection, we had maybe, 15, 20 people, something like that. Harold French Dodge and a few others on them. And we knew each other quite well. Two of the secretaries lived out on Long Island. I used to commute with them on the Long Island Railroad and things like that, you know. So we had very friendly personal relations on a small group basis.
Mm-hmm. So Dodge was there also, because he later went on to make quite a name for himself in quality control.
That's right, yes. Well, he came in after me. Mm-hmm. See, I was the first technical, and then Dodge came in, and Edwards is on the side. Over there's a Miller. Mm-hmm. Got his first name now, who was very active on there, too.
Was R.L. Jones somebody who was... He was just the person to whom Schuhart reported? Or
yes, I don't recall his role.
Because here we have an article from the Bell Labs records on the inspection engineering department, which has information on some of the people who were there and photographs of them. You might want to just...
Inspection engineer, approximately 85 person, directed by Jones. Oh, Quarles, yeah, Don Quarles, I remember him.
What connection did he have with your group? Or
well,
was
he was sort of carrying on a parallel work, as I recall, was he in the tube shop or something like that, anyway, mm-hmm. in another part of the Bell system. And maybe it says on here. I remember the name, Quarles. Yes, Quarles had five engineers reporting to him, and this is in the apparatus inspection department. Nature of the fault, and so on.
And I believe that further on it shows Schuhart and Edwards.
Yes, Edwards, yeah, I remember G.D. Edwards. Okay. Sure, yeah. And S.C. Miller, I was trying to S.C.
Miller.
Well, they worked very closely together, sort of a family relationship. Our desks were not far apart. We'd see each other often. And of course, I was, here's Harold French Dodge. I was pretty young at that time, and later on, if I'd gone back there now, I probably would have looked for relationships or things like that, mm-hmm. which I was completely insensitive at the time.
So So you said that Noyes came to visit you in the spring of 1926. Then.
Yeah, he didn't come east just for me, but he was there and he let me know he was going to be there. And so I went down. He was staying at the Plaza Hotel, as I recall. And when I talked with him, he said, didn't I think I'd ought to go back and finish my degree? And as I say, by that time I was getting nostalgia for the smell of the chemistry lab, and I did want to get my degree anyway, and I'd saved enough money by that time. I thought I could finance my way through it.
Did you have any thought at that time of possibly coming back to Bell Labs, or you weren't, or did you not think that far ahead at that time?
I didn't think that far ahead.
So in the fall of 26, then you were back at Caltech and beginning to work on your thesis work with Roscoe Dickinson.
Yes.
And I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about how things were when you got back to Caltech and how you got into the into choosing to work on photochemical composition and the quantum yield of photochemical reactions.
Well, quantum theory was, say, a hot topic at that time, and I got acquainted with Roscoe Dickinson through Tolman. He reported to Tolman, really, on the scale of authority out there. And Tolman was not an experimenter. He was a theoretical physicist. Mm-hmm. So he suggested I work with Roscoe Dickinson if I wanted to do experimental work. So it just evolved that way, nicely.
And you, in 1928, as part of that work, you began to, you published this paper on the quartz fiber manometer that was part of your research, and you've said before that you were always interested in working with your hands and in building instruments, that you've been doing some work on instrument making for the Caltech department. Was that around this time, or was that after?
Oh, that was the same time, and as part of my work assignment also. I'm not sure this is when I was still a student, I had this, but certainly when I went on the faculty, I was given custody of the instrument shop. So I had close association with instrument making and instrument maintenance. In fact, they had a course in instrumentation, and I taught that with using saccharimeters and things of that sort. So I taught that as part of my job.
It was a very different course in instrumentation than one that would have been given 10 or 15 years ago after... it was, I guess, a very traditional course.
Yes, it was just a routine instruction how to use standard instruments, saccharimeters and refractometers, things like that. There was nothing in the way of theoretical development or anything like that. It was just a practical course primarily for industrial chemists, those who are going out working the sugar mills, something like that. They know how to use a refractometer, for example.
And would you have taught them how to use hydrogen electrodes and that sort of thing in that course? Or?
No, we didn't teach that. These were primarily, I don't think we had any hydrogen electrodes taught in that course at all.
No, that would have been a much more advanced instrument.
Yeah.
If we could just go back for a moment to Dickinson, and you told us earlier about Dickinson and Tolman, about Noyes. Some of the other people who were at the Caltech department by the late 20s included Linus Pauling and Ralph Wyckoff. Could you tell us something about them and about the people you interacted with regularly?
Well, because they were both in X-ray diffraction work, which is not my field. I can't tell you much about what they did. The Corey out there also was another one who did very great work in X-ray work. This is the time when Pauling was working on his hydrogen bond theory and that sort. He was very active, an influential member of the group of chemists out there. Wyckoff, I don't know too much about him or the name of him. We had, of course, Lucas was in charge of the organic chemistry department. He was one who was brought a lot of physical chemistry into organic. I don't know how well that's recognized nationally, but out there he was constantly making organic chemists know physical chemistry and know how to apply it in their research. Stuart Bates taught physical chemistry, and Ernest Swift taught analytical chemistry. Again, he was a very tough professor, I'm told by the students that had to take the courses on that.
Is that the same person you later rented a building from in Pasadena?
Yes,
I see. So you knew him.
E.H. Ernest H. Swift. Yes, he owned a building out on East Colorado Street there that he rented to a dry cleaner that couldn't make it go. So we rented it from him at an exorbitant rental of $50 a month for Main Street frontage on there. That was a time. That was the Depression. And he was glad to get $50 a month.
Well, sure. We should come back to that because that's where the first place into which Beckman Instruments, well, what at that time National Technical Laboratories expanded into.
That's right.
You mentioned some of the faculty who were there at the time and a little bit about the interest in quantum chemistry or the applications of quantum theory to chemistry. Do you recall if there was much contact between Tolman and Dickinson and the other students who were doing research with them and Lewis's school at Berkeley, for instance, which was another center for that kind of interest in physical chemistry?
So far as the relationship between Berkeley and Caltech, I'm sure there were cordial relations there, but say I was not in that loop directly, so it's only by indirection that I would know that. We frequently had people down from Berkeley in our seminars. That's one thing that Dr. Noyes had, regular weekly seminars, in which one of the main items was the preparation of cocoa. Have you heard that story?
No.
Well, we served cocoa. Dr. Noyes, in his typical method, you know, in his book on quantitative analysis procedure, everything is spelled out in the greatest detail. Well, that's the way he spelled out the making of cocoa. The cocoa had to be made directly from cocoa beans, no ground cocoa. And so he had printed up in the direction on the back of the door there how long you had to boil the beans and when you strained them and when you did this, that, and everything there. Well, this is the test of the skill, I guess, of the incoming graduate students. So every graduate student had to take his turn making cocoa for the seminar.
That's interesting. It's the sort of detail that we often don't get in the history books.
Yeah. Yes.
That Noyes's style percolated down even to that level.
Yeah.
Who were some of the other students at the time? Who were your fellow students?
Oh, my. Back in 19...
Did you share a lab with anyone?
Bill Hinckley got his degree the same year or the next year after I did. No, I didn't share. I had my own laboratory there. What do you mean? Come back to me now. I better go back and get a book, Caltech guidebook of that era.
Well, we can certainly check. Did Dickinson have other students at the time who were working on similar problems?
A few others, yeah. Not many.
Was everybody working on...
I remember there was another, Jimmy Ellis, who was not a student, but he was a faculty member. Mm-hmm. He came out from MIT with Noyes. He was an independent thinker. He played quite a role in shaping the way chemists were taught. He's a physical chemist. Jimmy Bell, I forgot him. He was the professor of general chemistry for the all Caltech freshmen had to take a year at chemistry at that time. And Jimmy Bell was in charge of that, and that was where I also took my turn giving the lectures on that. And that was part of what I liked. I devised new types of electric demonstration apparatus to illustrate the phenomena, particularly electrochemical phenomena, things of that sort.
Yeah, well, Robert Barton Beckman Instruments said that you had quite a reputation for those demonstration lectures.
Yeah. Yeah, Bob Barton. I remember him. Oh, and then Clarence Dunn. Now they're beginning to come back. Now, yes, Clarence Dunn went up to Shell Development until he retired. Let's see, Barton. Oh, there's Sam Eastman. Gosh, when I can't think of his names now. Trent Dames, Moore. Dames and Moore set up a geological consulting firm together. They were there. Oh, yeah, and Macmillan. later on won the Nobel Prize.
He
was in my class. Yeah. Yes, I had. We divided this freshman students into sections of about 20 each. See? We had 160 freshmen. And so the top section was the honor section that I had the pleasure of